there. Welcome to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. I'm your host, Carla Nappi. I just had a really good time and a really interesting time talking with Min-Soo Kang about his book, Sublime Dreams of Living Machines, The Automaton in the European Imagination, that was published with Harvard University Press in 2011. Now, this is a really interesting book to read, to think about, to think with, and to talk about for a number of different reasons. First, it's a really interesting case study of just an inherently fascinating problem, right? The book is a historical study of the automaton as an object, both conceptual and actual, in the history of what's variously termed the European or the Western imagination. So it's just full of these sometimes really funny, really disturbing, shocking, always really interesting examples of the emergence of something we might call the automaton in various times and places. It's also an attempt to bring together, and I think a very successful attempt to bring together, these very different ways of talking and thinking about the automaton in history. So on the one hand, the automaton is something that we might consider to be this kind of trans-historical, cognitive, perennial concept within the imagination of a culture, and at the same time, an attempt to really root emergences of the automaton in very particular contexts and very specific times and places. So it's really interesting to think about the ways that the historian can balance these two seemingly very different kinds of goals. It's also really interesting to talk with Kang about it because he, as a practitioner, writes both history and fiction. So we had, I think, a really interesting conversation about the particular demands and ways of negotiating those two kinds of writing in the same person. It was really interesting for me, and I hope you find it to be interesting too, and I hope you enjoy. Hello, Min-Soo.
Hello.
We're here today to talk with Min-Soo Kang about his really great new book, his recent book, Sublime Dreams of Living Machines, The Automaton in the European Imagination. Welcome to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society, Min-Soo, and thanks so much for making the time to talk with us today.
I really appreciate you having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And it is absolutely a pleasure to read the book as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, Min-Soo,
thank you.
Can you start us off by saying just a little bit about yourself and your background? What brought you to the field of science and literature and to this topic in particular?
Yes. Well, during my mid-career as a graduate student dealing with European history at UCLA, I thought I'd gone to graduate school to become a biographer. And I'm particularly interested in the era of Enlightenment, so I was training to become an Enlightenment historian. And I was looking at the lives of especially the most radical philosophers among the in Paris at the time. And a strange thing happened, a completely accidental divergence from my original topic. I kept on coming across the name of Jacques de Vaucanson in the writings of the people of that time period. And I had never heard of this guy before. But what was strange was that everybody was saying that this was one of the greatest geniuses of the period. Voltaire kept on writing letters to Frederick the Great saying that this is the guy you should hire. This is the guy you should get. Diderot, in his writings, mentions him a number of times. And obviously, I had to look into this. I mean, since everybody was talking about in a highly laudatory manner. So I found out that he was an engineer and a mechanician. But the thing that he was most famous for was that he invented three automata. Two musical figures. One was a flute player and the other was a drum player. And the third was the most famous of them all, the so-called defecating duck. It's a little duck that could flap its wings, move around, and you put food in its mouth, and a couple of minutes later, stuff came out at the other end. And all of Paris just went crazy over this. They could not get enough of this. People stood around in lines around the building to get a view of this. And as a result, I also found out that after the success of the Vaucanson automata, it set off a veritable automaton craze that lasted throughout the rest of the Enlightenment period. And one after another, you know, one more sophisticated after another automaton kept on coming out. And as it always happens with a when a historian just, you know, goes off his field, there's a this mystery to be solved. What was that about? What was the automaton thing? Fortuitously, this opened up this immense era of immense obsession with me, where I was looking into this, and I thought I sort of got a handle on the Enlightenment obsession with automata. And then I figured, you know, in order for me to properly explain this, I have to, you know, give the context for the previous period, you know, 17th century and the Renaissance and so on. And I ended up doing something that all of my advisors advised me strongly, strongly not to do, which is write a very general book. this is a no-no, and now we live in an area of extreme specialization, but I just, it's this almost this, mania that I think I must have gotten infected from the automaton craze of the 18th century, took me over, and I had to find out virtually everything. And so, you know, I narrowed down my topic for my book, and it goes, it deals with a very narrow period from the time of the ancient Greeks to the 1930s.
Very narrow.
Yeah, I just couldn't go beyond that. I just had to stop myself. And it's a comprehensive exploration of what the self-moving machine, which is, you know, how the word automaton is defined by, what it has meant for different periods in European history. To answer your question, I just stumbled upon this by complete accident, but very quickly, within a couple of months, I knew that this was something that I was going to have to deal with. And although I wrote this, big general book on it, I know that there's at least a couple more automaton books in.
It's so funny just listening to you talk about the kind of what inspired you to go in this direction. It's isn't that the way it works with all of us? At least all of us historians, we sort of come up with this question, topic, colon, what's up with that? And that basically is what
gets, absolutely.
It's so true.
You also find that, like, the original topic that you started about, it's actually not very interesting. And then this side thing that you were dealing with is that, oh, that's the real story. That's what I should deal with.
Right. It's one of the great things about this business, actually.
Yes, absolutely.
And talking about stories, actually, this is something that is very important to the book. One of the most powerful themes, at least from the perspective of this reader, that emerges from the book is the relationship between stories and literature and stories and history, or rather literature and history and understanding the genesis of the automaton in particular, but also more broadly. Now, if I'm not mistaken, you also spend some time writing fiction, is that right?
Yes.
Now, that's because, and as we'll talk about in the course of our discussion of this really evocative and very, very rich book, fiction winds up being, and fantasy fiction in particular, winds up being a really important case study for some of what you talk about in the book. Can you talk a little bit about, I want to ask you about this in particular, because I think this is especially fascinating to try to sort of get a sense of how your work in these different genres might inform each other. So can you talk, if you don't mind, for us a little bit about your work in fiction and your work in history? How do those two kinds of work that you do inform each other? What kind of fiction are you drawn to writing and so on and so forth? So anything in that area that you'd like to share with us, I think would be really great.
Oh, yes. I really can't imagine my life just as a historian, as a fiction writer. I mean, the two very complement each other very well. And in my own work, as a historian, the use of literature for the study of history is very, very important to me. It's something that I think about a lot, and and I teach a number of courses on it. And now the cliche about how one can use sort of the fiction, especially really great fiction from a particular period as sort of window onto the past. That's something that that a lot of people think about, and as a result, a lot of historians do use fiction from the period that they're teaching. But I'm also aware that rather than as a simple window, you have to be aware that the ingrained prejudices and biases of that time period, so that, you know, I teach my students to have a much more sophisticated view of it. Don't take this as, you know, an objective view. Just take this as a sort of distillation of a person from living in the period. Now, what I really love about fantastic fiction, you know, things that could be categorized in the modern genre titles of, you know, say horror, science fiction, and fantasy, and so on, is that of all the different types of fictional writings, the fantastic fiction from any given era is a sort of repository of the most extreme fantasies that that period has produced. And as a result, you know, you can get sort of the get an idea of what were some of the, you know, greatest fears and the highest hopes that the people of that era held. And in the case of the study of automaton, as you can imagine, it was absolutely essential because, you know, as you probably got the sense, I'm really one of the areas in which I find the automaton very, very fascinating, that it flips very quickly from, you know, just absolute delight and just fascination. And, you know, the self-moving machinery is sort of the greatest, you know, possible accomplishment of human ingenuity. But then it flips and it's like there's all the stories about robots coming alive to, you know, rebel against their masters and so on. Right. And you know, that thing that I'm really fascinated with, the way in which human beings would look at an automaton and go, oh, you know, what a pretty little machine. You know, how fascinating. They go, oh, my God, automaton, it's going to kill us all. Right? and you see that in virtually every period, even in Hollywood movies today. Think of all the, you know, ones that feature really, you know, nice, beautiful, ingenious automata versus, you know, the Terminator, right? In terms of your earlier question, I find myself... you know, one of the things I love history is that I do have to prove everything. You know, I can't just say whatever my intuition says about the past. And I like the rigor of it, the looking for evidence, and trying to get as much sophisticated handle on the evidence and drawing meaning out of it. But there's a part of me, that's the fiction part of me, that wants to be liberated from it and just tell stories, apart from not only the constraints of evidence, but from the constraints of maybe laws of physics. And as a result, you know, after I've done a lot of work on history, I find myself fleeing to fiction, you know, to liberate my imagination. And a lot of it comes from things I wanted to say as a historian, but I couldn't because there's just not enough evidence. Ideas and stories and possible interpretations that occur to me. But, you know, but as a historian, you have to work within certain parameters of plausibility and, you know, and evidence and so on. So I run to fiction in order to write this fiction. And so in my short story collection, which is called Of Tales and Enigmas, when people read those short stories, they'll see very clearly that this is a historian who have fled to fiction because there's all these kind of possibilities that I deal with, sort of alternate history, ideas and, you know, creating the history of, you know, a non-existent land and so on. And what's also interesting to me that once I've worked on fiction for a long time, I find myself yearning to go back to the certainty of historical scholarship. That to a certain extent, just dealing with fiction is almost too free and too structureless. And as a result, I find myself wanting to go back to the archives and go through the old books and triangulate evidence and, you know, and skepticism and so on. It's a great joy for me to be taking a break from either and be going back and forth. And as you can imagine, this project on the history of automata has presented me with a lot of story ideas that I could pursue through fiction.
I can imagine, and I can't wait to read some more of them, actually, afterwards. So, Anna, one final thing I want to ask you about this, because this is so interesting, and this is kind of, you know, selfish, because I am very interested in issues of craft, but I know a lot of our listeners are too, so not super selfish.
Right.
On a practical note, it sounds like you're describing your writing process as going from a period for focusing on fiction to a period focusing on history and vice versa. Do you alternate like that, or do you find yourself working on fiction writing and history writing at the same time, sometimes even in the same day? And so that's one thing. And second, what is your writing schedule like? Sort of how do you balance the demands of these different kinds of genres on your own time?
Mm-hmm. I absolutely do not mix the two. And so I go through a year or, many months where I only do history, and then I switch and I only do fiction. And that works very well for me because, I think, I don't necessarily think that this is, for everybody, but, I think I really do need to get into a certain mindset to be, to be doing history versus doing fiction. And that also has to do with following the rigors of the historian's craft versus the rigors of the literary craft. I think I'll find it a little bit too confusing for me to go back and forth. And frankly, because I'm used to doing that, I'm used to working intensively on history for a while, then working intensely on fiction. I can't imagine mixing the two. I think I would find myself completely lost, and the two spilling over each other in a two activities spilling over into each other in a not very positive way. And also, as I said, it helps when you work on history for so long that you kind of get sick of it. So when you pick up fiction, it's so refreshing. It's so wonderful. It's so great that I don't have to check my footnotes every other minute, right? And then and they keep thinking about, oh, what would other people in my field say about this? Can I, and so on. But then I work on fiction for a while, and once again, I'm like, this is great, but this is, at some point, I need something concrete. I need to learn something about the world I live in, and so on. So it's a great motivation, to go back and forth. In terms of my writing, John Updike once said that among all writers, there are those who write in the morning and there's those who write at night. And what's really interesting, he said their qualities of their writing is very different. He said that, the people who write in the morning, they tend to have, these are people like, Updike himself, people like Nabokov and he describes how their writing is so much more, the sentence structure is so much more clearer. The overall structure of the writing is clearer, and it just, the clarity is what really it comes through among great writers who write in the mornings. Writers who write in the evenings, people like Dostoevsky, they're clumsy. Their sentences may not be as clear, and they may be clumsy, but they have this immediacy that really shines forth that you rarely get with the morning writers. And the problem is that for so many years, I've been trying to turn myself into a morning writer. And I had failed at every turn. I just can't get going. And it's one of the reasons that I'm just not a morning person. I'm really groggy for several hours after I wake up. But I so admire that the kind of the clarity of the morning writers. But I find myself at my most productive after I finish watching the Daily Show and Colbert Report. Uh-huh. I start then, and then I may end at like 3, 4, 5 in the morning. I don't like this. I don't like it. I want to get up early in the morning and have a productive day and go to bed early. But there's something about it that I just can't change.
Well, whatever you're doing, just keep doing it, because clearly it's working, at least from the perspective of your history. But I completely understand. I mean, I tried to force myself into some kind of a writing schedule in the morning also for the past several months. And sometimes it involves just sitting down and, having nothing at all to say.
Yeah.
And just sort of starting groggily with your fingers. I am eating an English muffin now. The English muffin is brown. It's blah, blah, blah. I'm just kind of trying to. So.
Yeah. Well, also, there's less distractions in the evenings, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, especially after Colbert's report's over, there's nothing on TV to watch.
Depending on whether you have a cat or a TV on iTunes, so these can complicate things. But that's another story for another day. So the book itself, The Sublime Dreams of Living Machines, this is a historical study of the automaton as a conceptual object. So it explores two main themes, and you set these out at the beginning of the book. First is the nature of the automaton as an object and the source of its ability to arouse emotions in people, and not just any emotions, but powerful emotions and very conflicting emotions. And that conflict is going to be very important to the argument. Second is the consideration of humans as machines, and this conflict or ambivalence that elicits. So as you show in the book, the automaton has been not only an important presence, but also a continuous presence in what you call the Western imagination, so in a very broad swathe of history. However, you're very clear about the importance here of situating the idea, this kind of idea that permeates on a cognitive level the imagination of history, but situating it very firmly in very specific historical contexts to show how it functioned in specific periods, and also how that significance changed from period to period. So what I want to ask you about first, as we get into the real meat of the book, is to talk about navigating these two different aspects of the automaton's power, these aspects that you call the perennial and the contextual, or something we might think of as kind of the cognitive, right, and the historical. Can you talk about that relationship for us and how that informs the way you approached the history of the automaton in this project?
Right. That really captured the essence of what I was trying to do in the book. And that's been one of the harder thing to explain, because I also sense in the reviewers, there were also a lot of my reviewers was trying to wrap their minds around how the two aspects of it, the perennial versus the historical, sort of interact. I wasn't trying to say something too theoretically profound, but the perennial aspect has to do with the fact that, you know, I think there's an essential reason why the automaton itself is essentially an interesting object for people to ponder. And my basic idea is that, it has to do with the way human cognition works, how we tend to divide everything into categories, and all phenomena that tend to just go from one category to another, flip from one to the other, tend to cause a series of emotions like anxiety, sometimes fear, and sometimes even fascination. And the automaton is a prime example of an object that, you know, it's obviously made of dead matter, but it pretends to be alive. So it seems to go back and forth between the realm of the living and the realm of the dead, the realm of the natural versus the realm of the artificial, realm of the animate versus the inanimate, and so on. And under right circumstances, under different circumstances, it can cause different sets of emotion. Now, that's deliberately very, very abstract. And I made an argument based on sort of my cursory reading of psychology and sociology, because I did also want to really, really point out that just because that is at the really bottom why automaton is such an essentially interesting thing, that will tell us nothing about how specifically a medieval person regarded, the automaton, or a person of the Enlightenment regarded, or a novelist or a filmmaker working after, he's been through the warfare of World War I and writing, fiction or a film about automata. To them, it's tied in with their specific historical experience and their specific cultural matrix out of their come from. Now, I do argue that, at the bottom of it, there's a reason why all of those people return to the automaton as such a fruitful symbol over and over and over again through century after century. But that doesn't tell us very much, especially for a historian. That doesn't tell us really very much about why, say, for instance, medieval people, when they regarded the self-moving object, kept on moving back and forth between is this idolatry? Is this something evil that's being done here? Or is this, in fact, legitimate use of natural magic, a neutral form of magic? And there were others who are looking to this as a kind of a the promise of the kind of social and even moral improvement that could be made through the pursuit of the mechanical arts. So the thing that I want to do was first in the first chapter establish what I think, what psychologists have to tell us about sort of this, what could be the perennial source of fascination for the automaton, and then just take off from there and just say, okay, now let's leave the perennial and look at period by period. And it's all very different. What a Renaissance person may have found fascinating about a moving statue, something very different from what somebody from living during the Industrial Revolution in the second half of the 19th century found fascinating about a moving machine. It's a whole different array of emotions and that comes from different experience. In the same way that I think the way we react when we go to see movies like Terminator or movies like AI, where there's a very benign robot. It has to be looked in terms of what was really, what was happening during in America and elsewhere during the 1980s and 1990s when these films were being produced.
So this is you're mentioning psychology is very interesting, and this really gets at the heart of one of the really interesting kinds of work that this first chapter is doing. It's very interdisciplinary, right? You're ranging across history, literature, aesthetics, anthropology, and psychology. It's very, very rich in terms of a transdisciplinary project. So one of the things that I wanted to ask you before we go into the context-specific sort of capsule histories that you give us and these very rooted manifestations of the automaton in history, you are, I think, very convincing in your, arguing here for the context specificity of this idea. And we'll talk about that in its various manifestations. One of the things that you do that's very, really interesting, though, in the course of these chapters, much as this first chapter is embracing a very transdisciplinary approach, you embrace a very transmedia or sort of multimedia kind of approach in where you're looking for automata. So over the course of the book, we're ranging across fiction pieces, different genres of fiction, classical text, history, film, and so on and so forth. You are arguing that the concept of the automata is very context-specific. So I wonder, how do you feel about genre specificity? Is this, in your opinion, a genre-specific kind of a phenomenon too, or is this something that transcends genre?
I would definitely say it's the latter. The interdisciplinary part that you point out is very, very important to me because I think, not just as a scholar through my scholarly conviction, but by instinct, I am in full rebellion against the extremely specialized nature of academic studies these days. It has its place. I mean, I appreciate it when somebody goes really, really in depth in one very small period of history with one approach to history and so on. I find that very useful, but it's so hard these days to find attempts by historians to create these links that go, as I said, go beyond media, go beyond genres, and try to link them also. I just mentioned this very briefly, but I think there's a real need to perhaps start another interdisciplinary approach, which I call the history of the imagination. Right, to get one concept or one idea from one period or more of history and see how it spreads all across the culture, from scientific texts to philosophical texts to literary texts to to popular culture even and so on, and to trace that and deliberately make a point of making those connections. And I think so much would be lost if this trend of extreme specialization our profession is, becomes more and more exaggerated, where we keep producing more and more people who know more and more about less and less. I think that's the sort of the cliche that they use, right? Mm-hmm. I think the history of imagination would be or push in the other direction, which is not to denigrate specialized history in any way, but use those wonderful knowledge that are being produced by specialists as one among a series of other works to make connections. It was so much fun for me to say, for instance, take the 17th century and just scour, through all of its, writings for the word automaton, and to find it appearing in works of science and works of political theory and works of literature, and seeing how they function very similarly. In all of these different genres, and they point to sort of the common well out of which these ideas come from, and it was a lot of fun, and it was really interesting, and I feel that that's been really fruitful. I could have written at least an essay just dealing with automaton concept in, say, medical writings of the second half of the 17th century. That would be the kind of advisable thing that, a graduate student would write his dissertation on, right? I know that that concept that, that came out of the medical field, it spilled over into these other fields of literature and political theory and so on and so on. It was just too interesting for me not to pursue that, even at the risk of being a little bit amateurish as somebody who's, who'd be an interloper. That's the word that's often used when academics try to discourage, other people from going into fields that are not of their expertise. Don't be an interloper. Right?
That's right. That's right.
I'll say, look, let's interlope.
Right? Let's interlope. I think this should be a rallying cry for new books in STS. Let's interlope. No, I'm completely on board with this project. I think one of the interesting things that comes up, and then we'll, before I ask you about the second chapter, is that the kind of characterizing the imagination of a culture can involve you need to locate a culture, right? Mm-hmm. And so when you're looking at the 17th century, you're very careful in this book to say, look, I'm looking at something that I'm calling the Western imagination or the European imagination. It would be very interesting to kind of try to see what happens if you try to take a more expansive view and sort of, do you see what I mean? Sort of, can you talk about imagination more broadly? Is there a kind of circulation of imagination? Can we take this story and go global with it and what happens? And again, that's another project for another day. But as a China historian, it's something I got to ask.
Yeah, absolutely.
So after this chapter where you're setting up this sort of conceptual apparatus with which we can think about how to look for the concept of the automaton in these different contexts, and you raise a really interesting set of concepts, the sublime, terror and horror. You talk about Freud and the uncanny and Mary Douglas, really, really interesting kinds of apparatus here. You take us then into a series of very temporally located case studies. And the first case study that we look at is a case study set in medieval and Renaissance periods. Mm-hmm. So one of the important things that you address in your discussion of the automaton in medieval and Renaissance Europe is the importance of magic to understanding what's happening here, and here magic and its changing instantiations. So can you talk a little bit about this? Because this will recur as an important point in later periods too. Why is understanding the notion of magic in history so crucial for us to understand the changing nature of the automaton?
That was one of the areas in which I found it deeply fascinating. I loved doing research on it, which is that, the word magic I discovered, what medieval and Renaissance people thought about magic is, defining the word is virtually impossible because it was such a complicated thing. And there were so many different types of magic that the people talked about. The word magic could denote a lot of things that, that today we would firmly place in the fields of mathematics and science, particularly what we would call applied science, which at that time was, regarded as sort of a branch of mathematics. I mean, use of mathematical knowledge for what we would call technological purposes. And some of the arguments that raged during the Middle Ages and into the Renaissance was, you know, are all magic bad? Are, you know, are they all from the devil? Or are there some forms of magic that are from the angels or, you know, even directly from God? You know, is there a form of magic that's neither good or bad in itself? It's completely neutral. It has to do with, I mean, what they call natural magic, advocated by people like William of Auvergne or later in Renaissance, Cornelius Agrippa. You know, in other words, these are just knowing how to manipulate the laws of nature without dealing in any way with demons or angels, right? Is that bad or is that good? And, you know, there was no consensus position, on this whatsoever. There were some theologians who were hardliners who said all magic is bad, right? I mean, it's all either fraud or it's from the devil. And then there were others who say that, no, there's some magic is comes from God, and, you know, and the others that are completely neutral. I mean, you can use natural magic for the purpose of good or bad, but in itself, it's not good or bad. And under the category of magic, they placed for many people they place. Especially natural magic, the mechanical science of production of wonders. That's why in Catherine Park and Lorraine Dustin's book on wonders, automata appears constantly. I mean, that's in the sort of the collection of wonders a lot. The same discussion: is this idolatry? Is this something evil going on, or is this just just completely neutral, arrangement of gears and springs and so on? As I said, there was no consensus position, and that's what really made it interesting that these people agonized over it and so on. Now, obviously, the most the really really spectacular story the period that I specialized in when I was a graduate student. During the period of scientific revolution and the Enlightenment, they take this magical object of the automaton and completely erase any kind of magical element of it and turn it into a completely natural mechanical object. And they're at pains, these Enlightenment and Enlightenment people are at pains to explain that there is nothing magical going on. And they do something that no automaton makers before this time period did, which was, you know, what Vaucanson did with a flute player, which is open up the panel, mm-hmm. and show the people, see, no demons here, just gears, just springs, and that's it, right? And to me, that's really, so same object, but completely different meaning. It goes from magical to, an anti-magical device, right? I mean, the one that demonstrates in the Cartesian terms, that the world is, in fact, a series of dead matter, arranged into a form of machinery. But of course, later in the period, especially during the Romantic period, that magical aura returns. And to the extent that even today, we can't help feeling a little bit creeped out in the face of the automaton, that there is something uncanny going on, that there's something even unnatural that occurs. And that feeling that we still possess is, for me, during the Middle Ages, how they try to articulate that feeling in the language of magic. So the language have changed, but I think the emotional base is something that we still live with.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you so much. So in this introductory chapter, or after this introductory chapter on medieval and Renaissance automata, and you introduce two important cases that are really, really interesting. One, this magical speaking head, and another, mm-hmm. a list of famous automata in the work of particularly Cornelius Agrippa. You take us into a very detailed study of Vaucanson, who you've spoken about already, and his three most famous automata, and the context of Vaucanson within what you argue should be the golden age of the automata. Now, here we have not just a sort of moving away from magic and understanding the automaton, but a moving toward an understanding of the body in terms of a machine. And that's not just the human body, but also perhaps the body of the state. Can you talk a little bit about that transformation?
Yeah, it's one of the, for instance, intellectual historians of the period, say from around 1650 to 1750, that century. The language of machinery is everywhere. I mean, that's sort of, you know, people just really become obsessed with sort of describing everything in terms of the machinery. And it all comes together. I mean, the universe is a big, vast machine. The state is a big, vast machine, or it should be run like a big, vast machine. When a state is functioning badly, it's like a really badly functioning machine. The human body is a machine, machine. I mean, it's a really, really striking. One of the easiest things I had to do during my research is to find instances of the appearance of the word automaton from about, 1650 to 1750, right? I mean, it's everywhere. It's part of what intellectual historians have called, sort of the disenchantment of the world, ousting of all magic, trying to establish, among the elites, of course, right? Among the intellectual elites, trying to establish a new certainty, because intellectual historians of the Renaissance, especially the late Renaissance, talk about how the Renaissance was a wonderful period of these great discoveries and knowledge accumulation and so on, but it was also a time of great anxiety, right? Because all these old ideas are falling apart. Then the certainty of the one religion on the Catholic Church is shattered to pieces in the Reformation and so on. So at the same time that they were relishing in this creation of this great era of newly discovered knowledge, they're also at sea and just filled with anxiety about where this is going. Is this the beginning of chaos? Is this the beginning of knowing nothing? And the explanation for the rise of mechanicism in this period is that here you have certainty, right? So the language of mechanics, the language of machinery, is what's going to bring new certainty, right? So don't worry about it. Things are not going all to chaos, right? We're going to bring all this knowledge together, and we'll explain everything, but in terms of machinery. So we don't need you don't need like occult forces and so on. Machines. An interesting double effect. On the one hand, it does allay a lot of anxiety for a lot of intellectuals, right? So this is, here this is another new basis for stability and certainty and so on. On the other hand, it also gives rise to a lot of, what Foucault might call, sort of the control of the body and the state. Because once everything becomes mechanical, it gives power holders a great deal of, opportunity to use those very language in order to establish control, right? And the best example of that is Thomas Hobbes' Leviathan, right? I mean, in the Leviathan, it's just filled with the language of machinery. In fact, the big Leviathan is a gigantic machine that consists of little machines that are human beings, and that's really the legacy of that era of mechanicism that we live with. But of course, by the second half of the 18th century, that all falls apart. Vitalism comes back with with great strength and questions the entire mechanistic world order.
One of the really interesting things that I think the work raises that I hadn't thought about so much before is whether we could even do the same kind of treatment that you're doing for automaton here and look at the idea of a machine, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, sort of how does this even change in these different periods what a machine is and mm-hmm. how that's understood. So after taking us from this period, you look at a context in which the image of the automaton man is really transformed into something very negative. It's something to talk about humanity's flaws. And this is happening in the context of the emergence of sort of vitalistic ideas. Can you talk a little bit about the importance of vitalism and the sort of the discourses of vitalism for creating a new understanding of the automaton in the sort of late 18th century?
Right. I think to me, this is one of the... of all the things that I discovered and I found, I think this is the one that interested me the most, which is, to put it simply, I think one of the greatest and when I say greatest, the most influential legacy of the Enlightenment, even to our time, is this double notion of what a mechanical man could represent. The sort of the automaton symbolism, which is, which since the time of the Enlightenment, it's just you know, that the Western culture has been packed with, right? And it's a paradoxical idea. It's the idea that on the one hand, machine represents power, machine represents stability, machine represents rationality, machine represents the clarity of understanding. And at the same time, by the time you get to the middle of the 18th century, the political situation in Western Europe deteriorates with a series of wars and so on. And also, you have the rise of a middle class, rise of literacy, and in particularly in England and in France, and they and they're disillusioned with the promise of the mechanistic age. So, and they frankly do feel oppressed by this sort of preponderance of the notions of machines, which has been used frequently for, you know, conservative, in some cases, tyrannical purposes. And so there was a sort of really anti-authoritarian element to this vitalistic blowback that occurs in the second half of the 18th century, where all of a sudden the mechanical man no longer becomes the rational, in control, you know, powerful, you know, mathematical, you know, a man who's part of a rational society, but he becomes everything that the new generation loathes, right? And that somehow, that, you know, in the writings of Rousseau, for instance, the mechanical man is a man with something really vital missing. He's forgotten how to feel. He's forgotten how to empathize. He's forgotten how to really comprehend nature intuitively, and cannot use his imagination and so on. And as I said, there's a real you know, clear anti-authoritarian tinge to all of this. I think even today, as I was saying, that notion of the mechanical man as the powerful rational man, right, is very much with us in the expression that comes from that Bill Murray movie. The name of the movie escapes me, but there's a phrase: "Mean, lean, fighting machine." Right? and we all, you know, when we admire people, we all often, you know, say that guy is a machine. You know, I mean, meaning, you know, hard worker, you know, accuracy at a task, you know, and so on. But at the same time, we often also denigrate people by, you know, saying that you know, that person's a robot. That person's, you know, that person's an automaton. You know, I especially during eras of political debate like we're having right now, people often denigrate supporters of the candidate they don't like and say they're a bunch of mindless machines, right? They don't think for themselves and so on. And I, you know, I locate that exactly in the sea change in the social and political crisis that starts to occur in the middle of the 18th century. And those two images are very much with us.
So, and one of the really interesting things about this chapter as well, and I'll just mention this for listeners, because we don't have like 3 hours, this is why I'm not asking you to talk so much about particular case studies, but the book, I'll say this for listeners, the book is just filled with these wonderfully, wonderfully rich accounts of specific automata throughout history, in addition to these very interesting and very evocative contextualizations of large periods and large-scale ideas within that history. And so, for example, in this chapter, chapter 4, you give us this really wonderful account of one of perhaps the most famous of automata. This is the Turk, or Baron Wolfgang von Kempelen's chess player, that I'm sure many listeners of the book will probably have heard something about if they don't know a whole lot about it. You also give us in the next chapter, you talk about another very famous monument within the sort of discourse of men and machines in this context, especially in the Romantic period, and that's Frankenstein. Mm-hmm. Okay. So after and there are many, many others like this. So I'll just say this to signal to listeners, there's a ton of really wonderful case studies and primary sources and things in this book that are very evocative. So after moving us through the importance of sort of vitalism and then taking us into the Romantic period, where the sort of the importance of German works of fiction comes up, and the automaton becomes threatening and dangerous in a new way, you move us into what you call the Industrial Age. And this is the late 19th and early 20th century. And this is actually really important, and it's very important in particular, perhaps, for people interested in science studies and STS, because you're showing here that the sort of understanding, among other things, the understanding of the automaton, the kind of conceptual work and social work that the idea of the automaton is doing, is rooted in the emergence of very specific ideas, including thermodynamics and very specific technologies, including the steam engine. So can you talk a little bit about sort of this context within the cultural responses to the Industrial Revolution and the steam engine and so on and so forth for the changing significance of the automaton in this period?
Right. I'd love to talk about that. But before I do, can I just point out one thing?
Of
right?
course you can.
About the Turk. Right?
Of course you can.
So this is the so-called Turk or the chess playing machine. I just want to point out very briefly before I answer your question that I find it really quite ironic that the Harvard University Press decided to put on the cover of my book illustrations of the Turk, the chess playing automaton, right? Because I specifically make the argument that the Turk wasn't an automaton.
That's right. That's
it was a fake automaton. The thing is, to defend von Kempelen's reputation, he's often been called a fraud and the machine was a hoax and so on, but he actually never claimed that this was an actual chess playing machine. I think one has to respect the people of that time period, and not think that, people were actually fooled into, and because, this is the 18th century. There weren't that many people who were stupid enough to believe that somebody actually made a chess playing machine. And for von Kempelen, this was always a dare, right? I know that this is some kind of a trick, but you figure it out, right? To me, that was worth exploring. So how, what that meant, but it actually was an automaton in the sense that, one of my sort of baseline definition of automaton is a self-moving machine, right? If something else is moving it, it's not an automaton, right? It has to have the devices and power necessary to move itself, right? And as, people will read, this wasn't self-moving, right? It was moved by somebody else, right? So I just wanted to point that out. Yeah, on your question about the role of the automaton in the Industrial Age, I found it really interesting when the Industrial Revolution broke out, there were two main responses that you could have. One is sort of the more what I call technophile position. This is, machines are going to save us all this work, and it's going to create a world, and industry will create a great economy and so on. So the celebration of the Industrial Age, and then you have the Romantic reaction, right? William Blake, calling the factories the dark satanic mills and so on, right? You go back and forth, and this is a very familiar topic for people who have done any kind of cultural study of the Industrial Age. People are agonizing over, is this good, is this bad, or, what are the good and bad, and, on the one hand, this great push toward the industrialization, on the other hand, sort of the Luddite reaction and so on. But then, once modernist culture is born, I just gotten really, really fascinated with this sort of new view of this that goes beyond either the sort of the classical celebration of industry versus and the romantic fear of it, which is that starting in, from the, say, the 1880s and so on, beginning of modernist art, modernist literature, and modernist philosophy and so on, I keep coming across these absolutely fascinating descriptions of the machines of the Industrial Age as a kind of a new living creature, a new living being. In that they are no longer these utilitarian devices that the classical technophiles envisioned them. Noah is this sort of this monstrous outbreak of the artificial that the Romantics envisioned. But you know, beings that are that have their own nature and that are very, very mysterious, and they're very different from human beings. And then there's a whole question is, what is our relationship to be with these machines? And that runs the gamut from somebody like Samuel Butler thinking that they're the next step in evolution, and that probably there's going to be a violent confrontation between human beings and machines, to later, you know, Italian futurists like Marinetti celebrating them, celebrating these brand new creatures, and that, you know, the future of humanity lies in our merging with these living creatures. And to me, I think that says something very, very, very vital about modernist culture and how it is different from, you know, both the classical and the romantic cultures of the earlier 19th century. And this notion of machines as organic living beings, which I find everywhere. I mean, everywhere in modernist writings. I think that's, you know, what one could, with some exaggeration, say that is at the heart of the modernist outlook on the world.
Thank you so much. And this is this chapter also, I want to just point out, has some really fantastic examples in it. And so I won't ask you to describe this, but I'll leave it as a surprise for our listeners. In particular, there's a story by Alfred Jarry called Supermail.
Oh, right.
That I particularly recommend. Really, really funny. This is just to say that there are some wonderful stories in here that anybody who's interested in the history of literature as well is going to find new things in here that they may not have known about. Okay, so after you take us into, and in the process of transferring or transitioning from the industrial age to the revolt of the robots and beyond, one of the things that becomes interesting in a new way, although this is present from the very beginning of the book, is the emergence of, or the recurrence, perhaps, is better a better way to talk about it, of the notion of servitude being mm-hmm. central, right? The idea of servitude in terms of understanding the relationship between automata, machines, and humanity. Now, the importance of servitude to the way automata have been understood throughout history is actually present from the very first chapter of the book, and it arises here in an important way, in part because, as you introduce in the seventh chapter of the book, the emergence of robots, right, and the term robot, this is very much of a piece with the discourse of servitude. So can you talk a little bit about that? Because that actually seems to be one of the themes that also traces this entire really wonderful diachronic history of automaton as a concept and as an object for us, servitude. That, why is that important, and in what ways does that shape what's happening, especially in the later part of this history?
Right. All throughout early modern and modern era, see sort of the linkage between sort of the notion of mechanized humanity with servitude. It goes even back all the way to Aristotle. And this is a really interesting section in Aristotle's Politics where he starts talking about the old legend of Daedalus and how he created his moving statues. And this really kind of very interesting leap forward in Aristotle's imagination. He says, wait a minute, if we really had those things, you know, we wouldn't need slaves anymore. Mm-hmm. And it was astounding. I mean, it's just really, I mean, it's almost like, you know, it's just this great imagined leap forward in terms of, and he said, like, you know, in fact, we could have all these machines that would do all these things for us instead of having slaves. So the notion of, you know, slavery, servitude, and mechanical being, that's been there all along and as potential, right? And also one could, like, you know, say, read Thomas Hobbes' Leviathan and said that, you know, the very mechanistic image of humanity, there's some issues of servitude involved in there. But what I see is that these themes that have been always there, I think, but not really fully blown. I mean, the potential to explore the notion of mechanized humanity as a symbol of, human servitude has been there. But It's in the period after World War One that that theme just completely blows up, and that becomes, I would say, one of the main themes of the automaton concept during the interwar period. And again, that's everywhere. That's everywhere in cinema and in drama and fiction of the interwar period. And I think there's numbers of things that are involved in this. One is sort of the continuing progress of the Industrial Revolution, because you see this sort of, you know, mechanized humanity as a symbol of human servitude in the writings of Marx and a lot of commentators on the Industrial Revolution. But what occurs in the earlier 20th century is the agonizing debate among Europeans whether to adopt the Taylorist regime in the European factories or not. Because on the one hand, it promises, you know, ever greater efficiency, but on the other hand, just the idea of a guy standing over your shoulder with a stopwatch, I mean, and just measuring, you know, how fast you do things and so on. I mean, it was just horrendously odious to the working class. But in the course of the war, I mean, you do have much, you know, sort of general adoption of those things. And so there's a sense that, you know, in the factory situation, people have been further dehumanized in a mechanistic way. And the experience of World War One, the high tech warfare, fighting against machines and fighting against machine guns, and just the absolutely devastating effect of it. And there's all these writings of World War One veterans in France, and Remarque in Germany and Barbusse in France, who constantly evoke the language of the automata, language of the mechanistic being, to describe what the soldier at the front on these battlefields had been reduced to. This constant description of broken machinery trudging through the burnt out landscape and so on. And also, in addition to this, there's sort of the lingering fear about the success of the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, right? And the attempts there to try to create a high-tech utopia. For a lot of people on the left, some hopes that that could lead to something, and a lot of people on the who are critical of it, thinking that they are in the process of creating a mechanized dystopia, and all of those things factors come together, I think the linkage between mechanized humanity and servitude has been there for a long time. It's as potential, but it's really in the late industrial period, and particularly after World War One, that it becomes a central theme. I mean, you cannot escape that theme. When you observe the how the automaton idea was used during the interwar period.
Thank you. Now, before we bring this to a close, we've taken up a lot of your time, but I just wanted to ask you one final thing before we wrap up.
Yes.
So the conclusion of the book brings the story to a close by looking at some of the ways that the automaton functions in contemporary culture, so modern culture. Where are we now in terms of our own cultural appropriation at this moment of the automaton?
All of these issues are very, very much with us. None of these issues have been resolved, and we are still very, very, very much, in my book, I use a lot of recent appearance of the word robot and automata to describe certain kinds of people and so on. I mean, you know, in the last couple of years and so on. They're very much with us, which tells me that Western culture still finds the robot and automaton symbolism a very, very fruitful one and useful one. One of the things that I've been thinking about, and I've been having conversations with people in cinema studies recently about this, is that I've been making very long lists of all the movies that Hollywood had produced in the 1980s and 90s that has robots in it. And what I just sort of generally see is that from the mid to late 1980s, there's this huge upsurge of production of movies involving dangerous robots, and the most famous of them being Terminator. Mm-hmm. And then you enter into the 90s, and all of a sudden there's this preponderance of movies with very nice robots. right? Like AI, artificial intelligence, and short circuit, and so on. Helpful robots. You know, the evil robot in the first Terminator becomes a helpful robot in the sequel. The evil robot in the first Alien movie, and you know, becomes a good robot in the second Alien movie, and so on. So from about, I think, 89 to about 95, 96, there's this sort of switch, you know, it's in the era of positive robots. And then the awful robot comes back in the late 90s. Mm-hmm. And the best, you know, best example of that is the Matrix movies, right? And at that time, all the nice robot movies that come out in the second half of the 90s completely fail at the box office. Nobody's interested in them, right? And again, and in the last couple of years, starting with WALL-E, I see sort of a return of the good robot, and I'm trying to wrap my mind around it. This is completely at an early stage of my thought about this, but I think the 1980s fear of the robot has something to do with the beginning of the personal computer revolution. Mm-hmm. That all of a sudden, almost everybody had to just handle this technology, and there are all these fears about: can I do this? What are the sort of the great benefits and also the great disadvantages of it? But by the time we get to the 90s, people find that it's kind of easy, and not only that, it's very, very it's quite indispensable. Everybody needs computers now, right? So your machine becomes your friend. The machine that, you know, which is in your house, which is in your office, and which you carry around, and so on. By the time you get to the mid-90s, the computer becomes a source. Not only have we forgotten all the benefits, we feel that we are chained to the computer, that it's dehumanizing us, taking us from nature, and it's also a source of danger. This is where predators are going after your children. This is where viruses are going to come in and wipe out all your data, and so on. And so the feeling of danger comes back. Give some thought about this sort of changes in the preponderance of the bad robot versus good robot in the context of what's going on historically around that period.
Great. Well, Minsu, thank you so much for making the time to talk with us. Now, there's a ton in the book that we didn't have a chance to talk about. As we wrap up, is there anything else about the book specifically that we didn't cover, but that you'd like to point out for listeners who may not yet have had an opportunity to read it?
Obviously for the purpose of the length, there's a lot of stuff that I had to leave out that I couldn't really explore properly, right? As I say in the introduction, I'm hoping that this whole book will be will inspire other scholars. As I said, I have nothing but respect for people who are specialists. Hopefully specialists could pick up on a lot of stuff that I wrote and write entire books on each of the period that I talked about in different fields. One of the areas that I myself would like to explore further, and that I'm planning to do this, is that there were so many things that's related to gender that I just could not deal with properly. Mm-hmm. There's a famous essay by Andreas Heusen about Metropolis, where he makes a very gender-centered argument about the female robot in Metropolis. Unfortunately, in this one sort of very short 3 or 4 page section of his essay, which he tries to deal with the history of automata, he makes a series of ahistorical arguments that I found to be not quite there, because he tries to see the same notion of gender and project it in the pre-modernist period, which I just don't think is there. And he makes this argument that there's part of modernist culture is there's this spiking off the fear of female sexuality, and he links it to also the fear of machinery and the fear of masses, fear of mass movement. And all three things are sort of, I mean, in his point of view, all mixed up in the modernist imagination. That's why so often female sexuality does become represented in terms of the danger of the machine. And that's in turn also represented in the danger, potential danger of people going out of control, the masses going out of control, and so on. To me, that's very, very modernist. I mean, I see only inklings of that, but not in major ways in eras before. And I talk about this article in the book, but his essay in my book. In the future, I do plan to look more deep, get myself, better familiar with more recent, gender theory, and try to apply these ideas to automatons and theory, because there's lots of ideas. In particular, I'm in the process right now of collecting all the stories that I can find from ancient times to today of a what I regard as a really ingrained myth. It involves a story about a man who, for one reason or another, is unhappy with natural women. Right, can't stand women, but he needs them, but can't stand them. Right, so the solution is to build a robot woman. Right? Now, this is a story. This story has been told so many times. It's a veritable, obsession in the Western tradition. I deal with one major example of that, which is Villiers de la Dame's novel, The Future Eve. That's just one of like dozens and dozens that I've been able to find so far. When scholars have dealt with it, especially, feminist scholars have dealt with these ideas, they've said fairly predictable things about what, such stories means, which is sort of the worst of the sexist and misogynistic fantasy about, being able to, again, the theme of subservience, right? Being able to control the woman, custom make the woman, and so on and so on, right? But what I think they have missed, and this is the issue that I really like to explore further, is that if you look at every single one of those stories, something always goes terribly wrong at the end. Mm-hmm. It never ends with a man living happily ever after with his robot wife. Something really catastrophic goes at the end. The robot rebels, and in sort of the more benign cases, the man succeeds, but then realizes, no, this is really boring. This is not what I wanted all along, right? And there's all kinds of variation, but it's I'm not saying that people who wrote those stories were secret feminists or just I'm not saying that at all. A lot of them I know for a fact were real sexist and misogynist, but I think even they are admitting that this fantasy doesn't work. it just doesn't work. I mean, it may seem like a solution, but it's at the end of the day, it's not something that will satisfy this man's desire. And that's one of the aspects of this sort of the gender aspects of the automaton idea that I plan to explore in the future.
Great. So, what's next for you? What project is inspiring you right now? Is that gendered aspect of the automata something that you're actively working on? Or if not, what's taking your attention and your time right now?
Oh, yes. The gender aspect, that's in the future. And I'm slowly collecting data for that to get into fully. As is my wont, time to take a break from all of this. So what I'm working on right now is a book of Korean history.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah, what I'm particularly writing about is a there's a literary figure by the name of Hong Gil-dong, and he's the Robin Hood of Korea. I mean, oh, that's the way he's described, and it's not a very good description. Today, as by complete coincidence, I am mourning the passing of Eric Hobsbawm, who died today, and whose works I've been a great admirer for a very long time. When I was an undergrad, I took a course on cultural history, and I read his book, Bandits. And he describes sort of the legendary figure of the noble robber, and it gives main different characteristics of it. He rights wrongs, you know, he takes from the rich and gives to the poor, he's invincible, and so on, right? And obviously, you know, I mean, you know, it's Robin Hood, but I remember as an undergrad, I was, you know, this guy's Hong Gil-dong. I mean, this is the hero that I grew up with when I was a little kid, right? So I was going to do a fairly small project where I was going to do a new translation, because for, you know, fairly technical reasons, the translation that exists right now, it's not, I find it unsatisfactory. And do a little, a longish essay introducing the figure of Hong Gil-dong to Western audiences. And I imagine something like, you know, a Penguin Classic kind of, you know, situation, right? But then I discovered, as I got into it, and I completed a translation and most of the book is written, I just stepped on a scholarly landmine, because apparently everything that, like, most vast majority of Koreans have believed about the nature of this text apparently is wrong. Because most Koreans will tell you that this is the very first work of fiction written in the native Korean phonetic script, the Hangul, which was invented by King Sejong in the 14th century. It's probably not the case. And most Koreans believe that this was written by the statesman and poet Hogyun in the 17th century. That is highly improbable, it appears. It's probably a work of an anonymous writer sometime during the 19th century. So I'm dealing with all of those issues, and it's a fascination. For people in Chinese studies, the comparable example would be the great epic novel Water Margin.
Mm-hmm.
Except that, you know, Hong Gil-dong is just one guy. There's no 150 characters, and you don't have to slog your way through 3,000 pages. But one of the legends is that, the guy who supposedly wrote it, Hogyun, he enjoyed Water Margin so much that he wanted to write a Korean version of it, right? I dispute that. I don't think that's the case. That in fact, other than the fact that it's a story about righteous bandits, there's very little resemblance between Hong Gil-dong and and any of the heroes of Water Margin. It's a nice break for me. It's a really fun project, and the big challenge for me is to and it's a different kind of challenge from the challenge of writing the Automaton book. The really big challenge for me is that. To make this a really interesting topic for Western readers who know nothing about Hong Gil-dong, right? Other than the fact that he's kind of a Korean Robin Hood. So the full translation is going to be there, and what I plan to be a longish introduction turned into an entire book of four different chapters, dealing also with sort of modern manifestations of this figure and so on. And it's a lot of fun. I'm having a tremendous amount of fun doing it.
Well, that sounds fantastic too. So when that's out, let me know and we'll talk for New Books in East Asian Studies.
I definitely will.
Well, Vincy, thank you so much. It's really been a pleasure, and congratulations and best of luck with your new project.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. Thanks so much, and we'll see you next time.